The Guardian.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, it's Tuesday the 6th of May. I'm Belinda Rhodes. On today's podcast, will we ever really know just how devastating Saturday's cyclone has been for Burma?
Without a doubt, it's worse than we already know. The state keeps on having to admit that the death count is higher. We saw some clips from state media just a few hours ago, and instead of reporting on the crisis, they were showing an opera.
CCTV doesn't seem to be enough. Can yet more technology help the police catch more criminals?
They're hoping now to add in one more refinement. They're going to use automatic recognition technology that's being used by the sports branding industry.
And in Bolivia, protesters use rocks and stones to make their feelings known.
The pro-autonomy people have retaken the school, and in the process have captured and very badly beaten one of the anti-autonomy protesters. The throng are now marching him off to somewhere. Half of them seem to want to kill him, and the other half seem to want to save him.
Plus, the race for the premiership title will go down to the final weekend. But first, a summary of the day's main news and a review of the papers with Sandy Waugh.
In Burma, the government now say at least 15,000 people were killed in the cyclone. 10,000 are reported dead in one town alone in the southern Delta region. Aid agencies are waiting to take in supplies, and Burma's leaders say they will now allow it to be brought in. Elizabeth Bias is a UN spokesman.
We had contingency plans ready for this cyclone, and food stocks, medicines, have been prepositioned by the UN agency like UNICEF or the World Food Programme or WHO, the World Health Organization.
And we'll have more on the cyclone later in Guardian Daily. Amnesty International has called for international action to stop war crimes in Somalia. It reports first-hand accounts of Somali and Ethiopians executing and raping civilians. Amnesty is asking for the UN to step in and for international governments to put pressure on all sides to stop the violence. Here in Britain, a man in his 40s will appear in court in Kirkcaldy in Scotland today, charged with a double murder. 25-year-old Michelle Thompson and her brother were found dead at their home in Fife at the weekend. Thousands of manufacturing jobs are now at risk because of the worsening economy, says the Confederation of British Industry. The CBI estimates nearly 20,000 jobs will be lost in the southeast. Only businesses in Wales are confident that orders will still be coming in as before. Ronnie O'Sullivan's become the world snooker champion for the third time. He continued his strong showing to defeat Ali Carter by 18 frames to 8. During the two-week contest, he scored 12 century breaks, including one of 147. But after the awards, he said he would now be taking a break from the sport. The competition for the winner of the football premiership is going right up to the final weekend. Last night, Chelsea beat Newcastle 2-0, leaving them still within range of leaders Manchester United. We hear a full report in Guardian Daily. The football story dominates the back pages of the papers, with The Express saying it's going down to the wire. Of course, the Burma cyclone leads most of the front pages. The Independent says that it is, in effect, a wind of change for the country because the military government has been forced to ask for international help. Then there are the continuing stories to show our weakening economy. The Telegraph says estate agencies are closing 150 branches a week. And finally, The Guardian reports that a police study has shown CCTV has failed to cut crime, even though billions of pounds have been spent on the cameras. More on the day's stories plus breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
Four days after a huge cyclone hit southern areas of Burma, aid agencies and media organisations are still struggling to get a clear picture of the scale of the crisis. Poor areas have been hardest hit, and Terje Skavdal, the regional United Nations head, says we have yet to find out how hard.
Here there are a population of 25 million people in the larger region.
It will take time to get the full picture of the damages and needs.
Well, state media has put deaths from the storm in the thousands, with many thousands more in severe difficulty after losing their homes and all their belongings. I asked Johnny Chatterton of the Burma Campaign UK for the latest he was hearing from sources in and outside the country.
Our sources are telling us that the amount of people that the regime has admitted are dead is far below the actual amount, and that some regions have had three quarters of their housing destroyed. essentially, the scary thing is our sources aren't telling us the situation in the worst areas. And that terrifies us because we know that there are going to be people there who still haven't got help like 48 hours after the cyclone hit.
So from what you know of Burma, how good are the authorities at dealing with things like this?
The authorities in Burma have traditionally totally under-responded to any crises. During the Boxing Day tsunami, they refused to admit how bad the damage was, and we still don't even know how bad the damage was. They stop international organisations getting to the hardest hit areas. Any that do get there are severely restricted in their work.
Are there any international agencies actually based in Burma?
There are some international agencies, yes, and they're being able to move around in some areas because they've got Burmese staff. It's traditionally the foreign staff that are most restricted in their movements. But they don't have a large capacity and they have nowhere near the capacity to respond to this. The people who should be responding is the military. They've got over 500,000 soldiers and they can use them as when they need to, like in the uprising last year, but they haven't mobilized them to respond to this humanitarian crisis.
That's astonishing. Why, is there any explanation for that?
The regime was seemingly taken by surprise by this, but they shouldn't have been because we knew in the middle of last week, the international community knew that this was going to happen, that this was coming, but the regime just didn't respond. They hoped it would go away. The official papers weren't warning anyone and the outlets weren't warning anyone it was going to happen. We suspect it might be because it was the ethnic areas that were going to be hardest hit, the kind of ethnic minority areas. And the generals who rule the country up in their jungle capital, Naypyidaw, and they're a long way away from the epicenter. So to them, it's probably not that such a big problem, but it's for the hundreds of thousands of people who right now don't have shelter, who don't have access to clean water or to food supplies. That's where the crisis is.
And from what you know of the country and the way the state media reports things, would you expect that the situation is actually worse than we already know?
That without a doubt it's worse than we already know. The state keeps on having to admit that the death count is higher. We saw some clips from state media just a few hours ago, and instead of reporting on the crisis, they were showing an opera. So it's fair to say that they are trying to cover this up within the country, and they aren't going to let the people know how bad the situation is.
And finally, there's supposed to be a referendum on a new constitution in a few days' time. How do you think this crisis will affect that?
I don't think any government should be focusing on a referendum when hundreds of thousands of their citizens are without shelter, are without food and without water. The referendum is designed to entrench military rule, and the regime are going to try and push it through at this time of crisis because they know that people are going to be more concerned with looking after their immediate needs than any governmental matters.
And for more analysis on that, go to guardian.co.uk/world. Elsewhere on The Guardian's website today, for news and analysis on Boris Johnson's first day in charge of London, go to guardian.co.uk/politics. The United States plans to turn Baghdad's green zone into the city's luxury quarter. For details, click on guardian.co.uk/Iraq. Good news for breastfed kids, apparently they have a higher IQ. That's at guardian.co.uk/science. And at guardian.co.uk/business, a look at how the market's reacting to Microsoft's abandoned bid to buy Yahoo. Britain has more security cameras than anywhere else in Europe, but you might be surprised to learn that very few crimes are solved using evidence from them. Now the Metropolitan Police is trying to improve things by developing a database of CCTV images that could help track the movements of criminals. I asked correspondent Owen Bocott how far the police have got with the project.
They're in the development stage. They're just beginning to put it together. It's a project that's been running initially from Southwark, but has spread into other London boroughs. And they now recognise that they're recognising suspects on the streets who are committing crimes, obviously, in different parts of the city to where they live. And they believe that they really need to have a better database so they can start comparing images and spreading them out to more people to see if they can hopefully track down suspects and eventually produce evidence that will be good enough to use in court.
And in order to be able to recognise people who pop up in different places and different settings, who may make attempts to disguise themselves in any case, they're thinking of using technology that's actually developed for other purposes.
Yeah, one of the problems they obviously had is the well-known problem of the hoodie. Muggers and those who carry out street robberies and more serious offences on the street obviously try and disguise themselves. They wear hoods wherever they can and hope they won't be recognised even if they are seen on CCTV. And one of the ways they've attempted on occasions to get over this is to backtrack through earlier CCTV evidence and see if they can find a picture of whoever carried out the crime and recognize him from his clothing and hope they can come back to an earlier moment when maybe he didn't have his hood on. But they're hoping now to add in one more refinement. They're going to use automatic recognition technology that's being used by the sports branding industry and the sports advertising industry, particularly software that often tracks the number of times a product appears in televised football matches, for example, and it can record it automatically. And they're hoping they can use that to focus on individual logos from clothing, maybe, or perhaps distinctive designs on somebody's clothes, and use that also to maybe help speed up and automate the way they can look back through previous pictures.
So this is obviously in its early stages, and we're a way away from it becoming a national database. But why is it that so few crimes are solved by using CCTV material?
Chief Inspector Mick Neville, who's been running the pioneering project down in Southwark, believes that an enormous amount of money has been spent on the latest technical gadgetry, buying new cameras everywhere. And London certainly is probably the most intensively watched city. An enormous amount of money has gone into buying equipment to cover as many streets as possible. But very few resources have been given over to for the police to actually try and analyse this material that's been captured to see whether it can be used for court purposes, and to try and speed up and automate where possible so that it can be a more effective crime-busting tool. And one of the fears I think the police have is that whilst CCTV is becoming more and more ubiquitous, there's a fear that unless their success rate is improved, people will begin to think that they're not really much of a deterrent and they won't be worried by seeing so many cameras, knowing or if they suspect that there's no one behind watching effectively, and certainly nobody tracking all the evidence and using it to bring criminals to account.
I'm Alok Jha, and on the latest Science Weekly podcast, what can the climate of the past tell us about the future? Chris Turney, author of a new book on climate change, is in the pod to help us decipher the messages from extreme weather in the Earth's history. Also in the podcast,
there is only one question: the universe, with a big question mark after that word.
We talk to Michael Heller. He's a priest and the latest winner of the controversial Templeton Prize. And has someone really invented a powder that makes fingers grow back? Well, of course not. We'll dissect another media calamity, the dodgy story of pixie dust. It's all in the latest Science Weekly at guardian.co.uk/audio.
I'm Belinda Rhodes. Still to come in today's Guardian Daily, as the State of Israel nears its 60th anniversary, a house in West Jerusalem encapsulates the stories of families on opposite sides of the divide.
We always had hopes that we'd get back our houses, but nothing doing. Rule present, absent. We are present here to pay taxes and everything, but absent, forget back our property.
But first, an autonomy referendum over the weekend in Bolivia seems to have done nothing but deepen divisions between people in the resource-rich region of Santa Cruz and the poorer indigenous supporters of the country's president, Evo Morales. The Guardian's Latin America correspondent, Rory Carroll, found himself in the middle of rioting at one polling station in an indigenous slum area of Santa Cruz City, where opponents of the poll were trying, by a means Bolivians often use, to prevent voting going ahead.
If you want a sign of just how polarized Bolivia has become, this is it. A crowd of hundreds of indigenous people, all armed with sticks, rocks, clubs, metal rods, bottles, tree branches, pretty much everything they can get their hands on, are now attacking a voting center. They're hurling, that sounds you hear are men trying to smash open the door to get inside. They want to burn the ballot boxes. And meantime, the people cowering inside are hurling rocks and everything they can out over the walls to hit the people on the other side. The protesters are inside, it's total chaos. smashing windows, hurling bottles at everything they can find. They're hurling rocks and bricks. There's a handful of police here with riot shields and tear gas, but it's not enough to control the situation. Those sounds you hear of people trying to smash down doors, they're doing a pretty good job of it. One of the protesters now got a ballot box. He's holding it up with a trophy. He's holding it up as a trophy now, he's smashing it. Meantime, rocks are raising down. So here we go again. After a break for lunch, there's the mob has gathered. They're trying to try to get another school or a voting center. So there's about 200 guys, again with rocks, sticks, metal rods, firecrackers. And they're facing off against a group of people who are trying to defend the voting center. Storming another voting center. This time the police are slightly better organized and they're firing tear gas. So everybody's got their own little canister of vinegar and a little cloth wrapped around their face. One of the convenient things about Bolivia from a rioter's point of view is there's always something nearby you can pick up and throw. There's rubble, dirt, junk, chopped wood, everywhere. It's a whole armory just right at your feet. The pro-autonomy people have retaken the school and in the process have captured and very badly beaten one of the anti-autonomy protesters. He's a young man, his face is totally bloodied. He's obviously traumatized. The throng are now marching him off to somewhere. Half of them seem to want to kill him and the other half seem to want to save him. The people who want to vote in the referendum are furious. They've just been attacked by a mob. They've now emerged from the voting centres to see if they can try to defend themselves. At which point now the riot police have belatedly intervened and seem to be siding with the rioters. These are pro-government police, and the rioters in this case are also supporters of the government. What appears to be one of the pro-autonomy guys has now opened fire on the indigenous people. He and his group have now turned tail. They're sprinting. The protesters are in pursuit. There's a large gang of guys with sticks and rocks chasing him.
Well, since Rory Carroll recorded that, I've spoken to him to find out why feelings are running so high.
Feelings were running high because the indigenous community feels that there's so much at stake here. They feel that the referendum was an attempt to ring fence Santa Cruz province away from the central government, which they support, because the central government is headed by President Evo Morales, who's the first indigenous president in the country, and they feel that he's making very bold efforts to spread the country's wealth and power to indigenous communities. So the fact that this wealthy province of paler-skinned Bolivians is now trying to ring-fence itself from that process. It's enraged these indigenous communities in Santa Cruz, and that's why they went rioting.
So what's going to happen now? The president has rejected the vote. How are the people of Santa Cruz going to respond to that?
It's a wait-and-see situation at the moment. We're watching to see whether the Santa Cruz authorities, who've now claimed this crushing mandate for autonomy, how far and how fast they're going to push that mandate. For instance, are they going to try to create their own police force? Are they going to try to take control of the gas fields here? And so forth. And also we're watching to see how President Evo Morales will respond. Will he hold out an olive branch of sorts and sit down and talk to his foes and try to hammer out some form of compromise? Or will the two sides just continue basically shouting at each other, and then that'll feed out to street level and allow people to continue rioting? My money is on some form of compromise, some form of messy compromise, which will actually cool the temperature.
And are any other regions of Bolivia expected to take this kind of action?
Yes, there are another three regions. near Santa Cruz that are also due to hold their own autonomy referendums. And just as in Santa Cruz, they're expected to pass overwhelmingly. And that's one of the reasons why it's very possible that Evo Morales will compromise, because he just needs to talk to these guys, because if he doesn't, this form of rebellion just threatens to derail his whole project, which is trying to spread pro-indigenous and kind of pro-socialist and some would say populist economic policies across the country. Now, if he doesn't somehow defuse this autonomy rebellion, then that project will just be blown out of the water.
And just finally, rioting is pretty commonplace in Bolivia and people are obviously used to it, but there was one man in your report there who seemed to be in quite a lot of trouble. What happened to him?
Yes, well, he had been caught by the pro-autonomy protesters while he was attacking a voting center. They beat him up quite badly, and half of the group wanted to kill him, but half of the other group actually waded in and to try to protect him, and then that was bolstered by the presence of journalists and photographers, and we were able to escort him then to police lines. So he had a very lucky escape, because unfortunately lynchings here are very, very common, and it's in the blink of an eye. It's very arbitrary whether somebody just happens to get a few scratches and cuts or whether they get beaten to death. In this case of this man on Sunday, he was very, very lucky. He was spared.
Rory Carroll in Bolivia.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
It's almost 60 years since the birth of the State of Israel. On May the 14th, 1948, Prime Minister-to-be David Ben-Gurion read Israel's Declaration of Independence. But opponents of the idea began preparing for battle right away, and conflict has haunted Israel ever since. As part of The Guardian's coverage of Israel at 60, Israel correspondent Rory McCarthy has visited a house in Jerusalem with a very particular history.
This is the story of a house in a smart district of West Jerusalem. It was built in the early 1930s from golden blocks of stone and has an arched central doorway and tall palm trees in the garden. Two families with competing histories, one Palestinian, one Israeli, have called this house their home. One family has a story of flight and dispossession, the other a story of immigration and achievement. This is the legacy of 1948, the year celebrated this week in Israel as the 60th anniversary of the founding of the state, but a year marked in a much more somber way by Palestinians as the beginning of their refugee crisis. In 1948, this house was home to the grandparents and uncles and aunts of Wilhelmine Baramki, a Christian Palestinian who was 13 years old at the time. She has clear memories of long summers spent playing in the house.
There were fruit trees also, a nice apple tree, a swing. There was a swing where we used to play on the swing. You know, those memories, that was for us something.
In 1948, a brewing conflict broke out into war between the Jews and their Arab neighbors.
My father told my mother, I can't keep going, we'll be shot one day.
When the fighting reached their part of Jerusalem, Wilhelmine and her family took the clothes they could carry and fled, imagining they would only be away for a short time. But days turned into weeks and months, and when they returned to Jerusalem, the West was under the control of the new Israeli state. They were not allowed back in. So they only went back after 1967, another war when this time Israel captured the remaining eastern part of Jerusalem. Wilhelmine hoped perhaps to reclaim their houses, but it was not to be.
Of course, we always had hopes that we'd get back our houses, but nothing doing. Rule present, absent. We are present here to pay taxes and everything, but absent to get back our property.
In 1957, the apartment in the house where Wilhelmine's grandparents used to live was bought by Reuven and Ilana Tsur. Reuven was born into a Hungarian-speaking Jewish family in a town in today's Romania. They survived the war, although they lost many close relatives in the Holocaust. And in early 1949, they emigrated to the new Israel. Reuven studied at university in Jerusalem and married, and then the couple were looking for an apartment when one day an agent showed them the house in Talbiyeh.
And I only saw the palm trees from the outside, and I said, this must be a mistake. That couldn't be that beautiful. It was empty, and nobody wanted it.
And so they made the flat their home and thought nothing of its previous owners. But then came the 1967 war, and Ilana had a feeling that the Palestinians who once lived there might return.
And sure enough, after a few weeks, comes a very prominent gentleman wearing a suit, an English suit, and looking good. And he said, okay, my parents lived here, and I would like to see the apartment. Emotionally, I felt awkward.
The man was Wilhelmine's uncle, Victor. And there were more visits in the years that followed, all remarkably amicable. But until now, there has been no resolution of the broader Palestinian refugee issue. There were around 700,000 refugees who fled or were forced out in 1948. And today there are 4.5 million. Like most Israelis, Reuven and Ilana say that to allow the Palestinians back would be unacceptable.
That's impossible, that is to say. That decision to bring them back, to let them back, is synonymous with deciding to do away with the Jewish state.
But like most Palestinians, Wilhelmine insists on their right to one day return.
And this is our land. We have the right to come back to our home.
Rory McCarthy reporting. The Premiership title will be decided on the final day of the season. Chelsea could have gifted it to Manchester United yesterday afternoon if they had lost to Newcastle. But the Stamford Bridge side secured 3 points by beating them 2-0. The result puts them back at the top of the league, level on points with Manchester United. The Guardian's chief football writer, Kevin McCarra, was at St James's Park.
Chelsea are often treated like an alien life form in English football. Yet the game as a whole owes them a debt of gratitude. Yesterday, they beat Newcastle United 2-0 at St James's Park and so ensured that the Premier League goes to its final day with themselves and Manchester United tied in points. Other teams fell by the wayside, like Arsenal. Liverpool, for example, just didn't get going at all. So therefore, it has come down to Chelsea to maintain the challenge. They are not as stylish as United and in fact, for that reason, will lose the league most likely on Sunday, because if United beat Wigan away, they will be champions again by dint of their superior goal difference. But forget all that. After those games, we have the European Cup final between Chelsea and Manchester United. And it looks at present as if Chelsea are the stronger all-round team. Against Newcastle, they gradually built up the pace until they scored their 2 goals in the second half through the increasingly effective Michael Ballack, and then another goal from Florent Malouda. Newcastle were impressed and indeed a bit overawed. Their manager, Kevin Keegan, didn't really give his old-fashioned tirades, but he seemed quite more so if he reflected that the top four in English football are now out of reach of everyone else. Maybe that's too melancholy, but this was certainly a show of strength. And Roman Abramovich may even consider keeping Avram Grant as manager. Really, it's hard to see how the man can do any better than this.
That's it for today's edition of Guardian Daily. Tomorrow's will be available to download from 7:30 a.m. Producing today, Andy Duckworth and Tim Mabey. I'm Belinda Rhodes. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.